both writes and directs about African-American and African theater. She's done a student production of Color Girls in Nigeria. In this country, she's directed Amen Corner. She directs plays from the Caribbean, Nigeria, and, well, basically Africa, she also writes. We have an article here in the library on the third on the Zaki Shake by her. She has a new forthcoming book called Ancient Songs, a Set of Lays, the Theater of Femi Asokishan, who's a Nigerian playwright. So that is
until 20 after.
I want to try to focus on 2 or 3 seconds of the text, indicative of the playwright's concerns and the way in which transplanting the play to a different cultural context changes meaning. Now, foreboding an elaborate mise en scène or set, which most Nigerian production units can no longer afford, the playwright begins his play about the triumph of young love over social conditions with a group of men and women deciding who will be the evening's storyteller. The narrator then announces that he will tell a story of reconciliation and drafts his colleagues into playing the various roles. But since there are more performers than there are character parts, some people must be cajoled into playing hills, door frames, verandas, and other needed scenic elements. As the drama progresses, the scenic elements are dismantled and reconstituted in accordance with the demands of the story. Your own songs, adapted for the most part from popular rhythms mechanism by which the scene changes are accomplished. But more importantly, some actors, as you will all obviously sympathize with, tire of playing hills and verandas or of watching from the sidelines. And so they seize parts from their colleagues and replay segments of other scenes so as to accustom the audience to the change. At the conclusion of other scenes, the entire company congratulates the actor on the quality of his performance. Though the points at which these ruptures in commentary occur are scripted into the text, in performance their frequency can increase or diminish, dependent upon the cast's collective skills, the specific internal dynamics of the cast at the time of performance, and rapport with the given audience. And so in this way, Schopenhauer continually thwarts any tendency towards an emotional involvement with the character's dilemma. And instead, he redirects attention to the mechanisms whereby the actors create illusion. Now, at Stanford, we assembled a cast of students, most of whom were not involved in art majors, because very few black students major in art. We used East Palo Alto community actors, I should say, for those of you who may not know, East Palo Alto is predominantly black community, that's across the freeway from Stanford. And we used Nigerian musicians living in San Francisco and Oakland. And we performed in a cavernous proscenium auditorium seating some 1,700 to 2,000 people. But we transformed it into a more intimate space by placing everything on stage. That is, by erecting seating in the round for about 250 people, with the actors performing for the most part in the middle, and at times using the aisles and walkways behind certain seating sections. Set and costume designer John B. Wilson and I, as the director, first explored the idea of limiting the scenic elements to what pertains or obtains with, in a traditional setting, namely by limiting scenic elements to that which the performer might carry on stage. But given acoustical problems, we eventually hung four large batik panels at strategic spots. And as you will see from the few slides I have brought with me, he painted the floor in muted greens and browns using a religious symbol signifying the unity of opposing forces. But other than those few elements, we made no attempt to disguise be very definitely in the theater and going about creating illusion in front of the audience's eyes. Musicians and actors all wore Nigerian-style clothing made from about three commercial designs. And in order to further emphasize the sharing of character amongst a number of actors, Wilson designed a batik shirt and skirt which functioned as a signature item and was given to anyone playing the role of the young couple. So the audience literally saw people change costume, or actually add on costume on the stage. Now, one of the segments of this modified kind of Romeo, what to us in the West might seem a Romeo and Juliet story, I wanted to talk about both because of the importance of the issues, the manner in which the playwright left them unresolved so that the audience would have to decide its own conclusion, come to its own conclusion about it, and also what cultural transplantation meant for us at Stanford. Now, this first episode involves a discussion of the artist's social role. Now, prompted by the suitor's plea for advice, one musician relates the circumstances under which his wife, Folawe, left him. Folawe has absorbed a more liberating vision from a young man who not only questions the dishonest means by which government officials become millionaires, but also grapples with the custom whereby musicians compose celebratory songs for wealthy patrons. Now, given the length with which Volare expresses her commitment to an art progressively confronting its material foundations, and given the logic whereby artistic practices are linked to irrefutable claims or ills claiming Nigerian society, one senses that this character, who is arguing for an art, a progressive art which stimulates social change, one senses that this character functions as a voice for the playwright. But what the playwright does is also to balance this position against another one, argued with equal eloquence, and also support from the socio-political realities of contemporary Africa. The husband of Tai despises the destructiveness of self-appointed leaders and reaffirms a belief in the pristine quality of art, which, as he argues, intrinsically takes precedence over politics. He says at one point, revolutionaries come with every season. The words of fire flare and fade to ashes. Only the songs of the artists remain. So that while he says that playwright is arguing a committed art, he nevertheless puts these words into one of the character's minds. Now, Schopenhauer further counters the Dambunda's position by locating this discussion within a framework which threatens to subvert views. That is, the whole encounter is introduced by a common debate concerning the virtues of polygamy. And once the debate about the relationship between artistry and politics was concluded, that byplay is continued. So that we have a situation where the issue of the artist's responsibility to society is lodged within a framework which seemingly devalues its significance. It seems as though that the artist, the playwright, simply abandons the topic, and yet the topic is of intense importance in Nigeria, and specifically, obviously, in Nigerian literary circles. So that the incident exists as a kind of discrete entity which isn't harmonized into a whole, and which the audience must figure out why it's important. And now, the cultural context of the performance also quite obviously shapes how the audience evaluates this segment. That is, in Nigeria, playing most likely on a proscenium stage, which doubles as a university lecture hall, Nigerian performers enacting the role of husband and wife would probably initially have kind of intimate, realistic setting of husband and wife arguing. But then they would periodically break that illusionary fourth wall of isolation from the audience in order to log the patently ideological lines directly to spectators. Now, given a discourse in which both the communal ethic of the past and the more individually oriented perspective introduced by colonialism endures legitimacy, the audience, which is composed largely of students and other educated elites, would recognize a kind of concrete referentiality of the debate. And moreover, some observers might offer a variety of spirited responses simultaneous with the actor's line. In fact, I've seen that happen in a number of performances. The actors are acting on stage, and the audience is at times commenting on what's going on and being very astute about those comments too. And then again, the audience might comment again at the conclusion. Now, in contrast, I think the debate may be expected to have much less resonance with an American audience, because its discourse, an American discourse, privileges the expression of individual aspiration, virtually unfettered by any group concerns. Thus, the actors might be more likely to play the scene realistically, as though they were totally oblivious to the audience's presence. And were the scene to be played didactically as an instance of agitprop, it is probable that spectators would read Filawe's voicing of group solidarity as embarrassingly cliché. And so that the return to the male repartee concerning polygamy, which closes off the segment, might very well tend either to erase the impact of the husband-wife debate, or mark it as an extended, inconsequential element signifying poor craftsmanship. Now, in fact, in both rehearsals and performance, this section of the script proved one of the biggest challenges, in part because the actor who had joined Filawe was relatively inexperienced, but I also suspect, more importantly, because neither the actress nor the audience, an audience which, of course, at Stanford is a privileged audience of students and suburbanites, have a compelling reference point for the discussion. I wanted to try to describe one other entity in the play, and then to show some slides that relate to it. Because just as this sort of debate is not subsumed into a larger whole, we also had in the play a folk tale about the most handsome stranger, which also seemed to be another instance of an issue abandoned in midstream once its use for theatrical spectacle had been accomplished. Now, the story of the most handsome stranger is offered as a divinely inspired explanation of the mother's disapproval of this proposed marriage. And the tale concerns a young woman's inability to see beyond a handsome stranger's exterior, so that despite all the warnings from family, friends, and the stranger himself, she follows the man. He transforms himself into a crocodile and consumes her. And now, because the thrust of the tale's moral is clear from the outset, and because its specific content is also known to many Nigerians, the audiences may be more objective about it and focus on, and hopefully delight in, the skill with which the performers reenact, or the skill in which they play this spectacle. In addition, the Chopisson interjects contemporary elements into the traditional tale, so that although the stranger's enticing physical attributes are described in temporally neutral terms, his actual pronouncements locate him in the specific context of neo-colonialism. And then this traditional folk tale is repeated in this time in a fully contemporary mode, because the mother, I suppose, sensing that she hasn't quite accomplished her task of blocking this marriage, then offers a secular explanation of her objections to her daughter's proposed marriage. And she tells the story of government officials who promise the villagers agricultural miracles, but leave in his wake only dissension, betrayal, and death. And that approximates the earlier story, because both reenactments describe a category of individuals willing to accept highly commercialized alien values which fracture and impoverish their communities. And as such, both raise conceptual issues at the heart of African and third world development. Nonetheless, these stories are dramatized in a manner which encourages the creation of spectacle. And as Alan Ricard has suggested, it should alert us to focus on the pragmatics of performance as a shaper of meaning. As I tried to suggest earlier, the potential for audience distancing generated by the familiarity of the most handsome stranger tale may indeed be realized, thereby stimulating Nigerian observers to reflect upon a specific social critique. But equally, it seems to me, there also exists the possibility that just the delight in the spectacle, the ingeniousness with which the spectacle is accomplished, may critically overtake any critical sensibility. Now, particularly in the story of a stranger's transformation into a crocodile, as played before an American audience, is this possibility likely? Because the spectacle relates primarily to the supernatural, viewers unfamiliar with the tradition of any kind of magical realism, and viewers accustomed to devaluing that which lies outside rational thought processes may sense that this incident has functions that have little challenge to their own attitudes. Now, given an interracial cast at Stanford, the story of the most handsome stranger and its companion tale about a corrupt agricultural officer allow us to succinctly reprise the colonial and post-colonial experiences. That is, as you'll see from the slides, the most handsome stranger was played by a white student dressed in a safari outfit with the flags of Britain, France, and Portugal on his helmet. Following him was a black student who dutifully carried a big basket. Together, they were meant to suggest all those old movies we have seen of Africa, in which the superiority of Europe is capitally signified. To symbolize the contributions of civilization, of Western civilization, our stranger gave the natives an electric light bulb and a can of Pepsi. The former, we are hopefully in humorous terminology terms, to signal the technology which has significantly liberated people, and the latter also to signify the dubious needs which capitalism has created. In the story of the agricultural worker, the position of the two actors were reversed. Now it was the black student who entered first, dressed in an outlandish Western-style suit with Naira or Nigerian currency prominently displayed so as to impress the villagers with his personal sophistication and the promises of instant wealth. Chauffeuring him, or rather I should say driving him, and indeed controlling the direction in which they were traveling, was the white student, suggested, we hope, of the foreign experts who come to Africa and advise and actually control what is known as development. Now, in those two instances, I deliberately cast along racial lines. But throughout most of the play, and particularly in some of the scenes related to familial tensions, I cast colorblind. Now, on our campus, colorblind casting for drama department productions usually does not occur. Or expressed differently, it happens only on those occasions when we have a non-white student whose acting talent clearly surpasses that of all the white students. The results are, of course, that seemingly mediocre white actors have an opportunity either to improve their skills or to demonstrate their lack of talent. While black students take acting classes and don't audition for productions, which after all are time-consuming and potentially hazardous to one's academic standing, or they wait for the one black play of the season, the joint drama Committee on Black Performing Arts production, which I direct. Now, I wish I could boast that I had deliberately advertised auditions so as to solicit black, white, and Latino students, but I did not. Yet, presented with an opportunity to cast colorblind, I gladly seized the chance because it allowed me to counteract audiences' tendencies to view Africans as some exotic other. Namely, I hope that audiences might have some subliminal, might make a subliminal message concerning, this is the play about ethnic tension and ethnic turmoil, that in seeing white and black actors on stage, they might also make the connection with the United States and our own ethnic turmoil. And also, in terms of directiveness, in that the average American audience knows extremely little of Africa and the Caribbean, other than sort of media-generated images of safari animals, starving children, or sun and surf, it seemed to me that as a director, I had to try to strive simultaneously to execute two contradictory moves. That is, trying to render the complexity of the text's cultural universe, in addition to trying to narrow the psychological distance or the comfort zone, which allows the audience to maintain a category of a racially derived other. Namely, trying to insist upon the identity or the self-sameness of the supposed other by attempting to effectively reposition the viewer onto this foreign terrain. And notice that I'm suggesting that in directing and also writing criticism for that matter, that one starts by according creative autonomy and development, that one starts by acknowledging particularity. You know, that we don't run away from that before trying to seek areas of commonality. And furthermore, this is, I guess, the last point, that at Stanford at the time, we were in the midst of a long, protracted debate about Western culture's position in a core curriculum, and a debate that at times became appallingly racist. So that this production gave students a chance, or students of various races, a chance to come together to explore their similarities, their differences amongst themselves, and also their relationship to what was clearly another culture. Now, I hope that images of such cooperation, along with for the audience, vicarious experiencing of both difference and identity within the relatively safe arena of theater, might encourage viewers to contemplate different social relations outside the theater. And what I'm trying to suggest is that what we cannot begin to envision or imagine, we cannot begin to affect. If we can't see that on stage, then I don't know how we're going to be able to affect it within our lives. At a point which I suppose to some feels like a crisis in which cherished values are collapsing, at a point which to others feels like a challenge in which definitions of identity and agency are being reconstituted, I think we need to use theater consciously and more imaginatively to negotiate these tremendous shifts in paradigms that we are in fact undergoing. Now, just in conclusion, in Mashoki Saw's Farewell to Hannibal Rage, the young couple overcomes familial resistance and defies divine prophecy in order to marry. Yet given the fact that one family patriarch commits suicide, it's left to the audience to decide whether that death is a harbinger of more troubles to come or a nutrient from which new life will flow. Now, I would suggest to you that 10 years before the beginning of the 21st century, we theater artists whose very craft and passion center upon exploring configurations of identity and difference can choose to help to move our society towards bidding farewell to many of those old entities which threaten to consume the world.
Jennifer, if we turn the lights on here, will we cut that on? Are they going to? Okay, we're going to be in the audience.
The people in the background playing the scenic elements. And again, this is a sign of the daughter meeting her mother for the mother's approval. Now, the women off to the right and left are supposedly playing the fencing around the family compound. And as you can see, the greens and browns on the floor. I doubt that anyone in the audience knew what this religious symbol was, but I suppose I included it in part believing that it could help us in our work in terms of its own presence. Another slide where this is the young man asking his uncle for approval. Now this was also an instance where the actors changed roles, because the very first scene with the young man was also the student. So this is the second person in this role. And in the backdrop, we have again maps used to suggest the house. This is the most handsome stranger telling the indigenous people about the wonders of his civilization. That's a light bulb, as you can see. a scene where he is about to take off, and there's the young woman running behind him. And behind her is her family. And you can see that the actress's wife, the father is Afro-American. Okay. There, the most handsome stranger is beginning to metamorphose into the crocodile. And this crocodile was, I guess, built on the kind of order of a Chinese dragon costume. So that all over the crocodile's back for scales, we used currency from European countries as well as Nigerian money. I mean, facsimiles, of course, but mainly from European currencies. This is the transformation, beginning the final point of the transformation, where the young woman is fixed, can no longer move, and of course with the smoke machine and using the trap on the floor, we have the crocodile's head come off. I mean, we wanted very much so to create a spectacle to the light of the audience. And there he is in his full glory. This is, as I've suggested, the companion tale. What happened with the two patriarchs had in effect killed each other, and they had some of the best land in the village. And in order for this agricultural worker to run his scheme, he had to get village elders, a scheme was concocted to set these two men at odds. So that what the playwright does in fact is to link economic situations to symbolic codes, social codes related to family responsibility. Because of course once that had happened, the young man had to avenge his family's honor and have nothing to do with it. Yes. Yes, he's written about 12 plays now. Farewell to the Cannibal Rage is indeed published. And there is one collection called Moral Tutum, which is a collection of three plays. He's consciously chosen to use Nigerian publishers rather than to be published abroad, because once it's published abroad, his own audience doesn't have a foreign currency to be able to buy the scripts. So it's not as if you go to any bookstore and find it easily, but I don't know as to what your the library's holdings might be in the area of African drama, but he should be here. And I didn't mention Troyenko, but I'm convinced that this man is intelligent, is prolific, and that with some time, his name will be as well known as Wally Troyenko. Yes. The audience's responses were generally quite good. They could respond to the humor, to the spectacle of it. No one I've read specifically came up to me and said, I think it's great that you're using an interracial cast here. So I don't know whether that was what was an issue for them. I would hope so. I think in working in this area, it's necessary to try to lessen the tendency to exoticize to distance. But I don't know, because I didn't specifically try to assess audience reaction.
We have to close the session at this point.
Well, I think. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Please feel free to.
Well, thank you very much.